Hello, everyone, and welcome to Conversations on Sex, Addiction, and Relationships. I'm Tim Stein, and I'm joined today with my friends, Dan Drake, Wendy Conquest, and Jeannie Vitone. How are you all doing today?
Good. You're going to fire a mailbag question, so I'm a little feeling a little anxious. I don't know what we're going to get.
I am.
Well, we're gonna get into mailbox, and we don't all know what the questions are. So just for the listeners to understand, like, Tim's got the questions, and you guys are going to get us being spontaneous and knowledgeable, and hopefully we have great things to say.
I'm in the position.
These are questions power. That people have mailed in. So with every episode that we do, we invite people to send questions. So these are questions from our listeners.
Thank you very much for sending them.
Thank you for sending them. Excellent.
Absolutely. So here is our first question. Could a sexless long-term marriage be a reason for sex addiction?
Can I go first?
You can go first. I know your answer.
No. No. And okay, so now here's my long version, right? A sexless marriage. Yes, that may, if it's not both people's choice together, that could have many difficulties and problems and stuff to talk about. However, sexlessness does not create addiction. In someone's mind, it might be their rationale justification to continue an addictive behavior or poor decision making or bad judgment. But sexless marriage does not mean that is the cause of an addiction. Addictions usually start so much earlier, you know, in the emotional landscape of what's going on.
Well, and,
so that's my first. What do you guys think?
I heard this question different. I heard, ooh, is sexlessness a reason for sex addiction? So what I heard was, if I'm in a sexless marriage, does that mean that my partner's sex addicted? That's what I heard. And I would say, if your partner is not interested in sex, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're acting out with other sexual content.
Oh, so you were saying if we're not having sex, does that automatically mean that someone is either addicted to sex or betraying vows and such, like stepping out?
Right. That's what I heard.
Oh, how interesting. It's not what I heard. Right. What about you guys? What did you hear, Dan?
I heard it. I went two different ways. I could see someone, on the one hand, let's say for whatever reason, the partner or the relationship, for whatever reason, there's some issue. They're not having sex, or they're not able to, or they, you know, it's ceased on some level, that, like a justification for the betrayer to go outside the relationship. I heard that. Or, but what I do see is what I would imagine is this is about probably more intimacy anorexia. That's what I see, or sexual anorexia. So I don't know. We can go down that road. I'd love to talk about that for a second if we can.
Sexual anorexia.
Patrick Carnes talked about sexual anorexia. Doug Weiss is the first person I've heard talk about intimacy anorexia, mm-hmm, as the pervasive pattern of withholding in the relationship. And I usually see those men, typically men I've worked with this, they'll tend to be very afraid of rejection. So they'll stay pretty guarded. They're very hypersensitive to criticism. They'll kind of be guarded, very walled up and guarded. They'll kind of keep their partner at bay. So, and they'll do things where they'll kind of invite connection, but then push the partner away. And in those cases, I see those men may very well act out with porn and masturbation as a substitute for sexuality that they're not taking risks for, or they're not engaging in the relationship. So I do see that happen a lot. It's not the sexlessness that caused the addiction. I would say it's a bigger, more pervasive problem of the intimacy disorder that sex addiction is. So I don't know if what you guys are hearing, but that's what I see it as.
We know that sex addiction has its roots in childhood, has its roots in trauma, and has its roots in the neurology that gets wired into their brain as they're managing their trauma, and they have found sexual behaviors as a way to take the edge off and to not be overwhelmed by their trauma. So sexlessness in a marriage, from my perspective, is absolutely not something that causes sex addiction. I do think that there's an interesting question, which is it the chicken or the egg? Is it that there's sexlessness in the marriage and that sexlessness is coming from some reason? Or I've also seen many times, you know, addicts, like Wendy was saying, you know, it's not, if you're in a sexless marriage, it doesn't mean your partner's a sex addict, but sometimes it does. You know, sometimes the addicts are taking their sexual behavior outside. Sometimes addicts have an attachment wound where they're unable to combine sexual eroticism and relational connection. And so they have to be in a relationship with the Madonna, but they act out with the horror, and they've separated those two things. But also, I've worked with many partners whose libido has just sort of naturally shut down, and they weren't aware of why, and they weren't happy with it, but it was a self-protection mechanism from feeling objectified by the addict. So there's a lot of stuff that goes into it, but you know, my simple answer is no, a sexless marriage does not cause sex addiction.
So would all of us agree to that? I would definitely say I do not. I wouldn't. I would say that.
You would say that.
I would say no. That sexlessness does not cause sex addiction.
Okay.
Right.
We're
all right. All right. What else you got in that box of goodies over there, Mr. Stein?
How do you not enable the sex addict's behavior?
How do you not? Okay, hold on. I feel like there's a double negative in there, so I got to do some flipping.
A partner is afraid that in some way they are enabling the addict's behavior. How can a partner avoid enabling the addict's addictive behavior?
I don't see partners enabling addict behavior, though. I see.
I see.
What, by staying in the relationship and not leaving? Is that what we're calling that doesn't seem like enabling. If someone's saying they step on their own value system and say, yes, do your behaviors, even though I don't like it or agree with it, but I'm just not going to say anything, or I'm maybe going to facilitate something, that might be enabling. But I don't know. I guess I would want to back up. I'm not sure I see most partners that I've worked with enabling the addict behaviors. Do you guys?
Well, I think that one of the pieces is, so a lot of partners will say, okay, you know, because there's a sex or porn addiction, if I have more sex with them, then they won't, you know, they won't do those behaviors. So that's a fallacy, no matter how much sex sex is going on in a primary relationship, that is not going to deter someone with sex addiction from acting out. So let's just put that down on the foundation. So we talk about, right, with sex addiction is holding the addicts accountable. And this is an area that I'm consistently curious about, because the partners will say, well, I don't want to be their accountability something, something. And a lot of times that goes to, well, I'm not going to ask them about their meetings. I'm not going to ask them about recovery. I'm not going to ask them about anything that's their business. And so either they're doing their work or they're not. And we did an interview with Michelle Mays, and her work is very attachment based. And so I think that flies against this newer body of research that we're finding, is that in any relationship there is attachment. So why wouldn't a partner go to the addict and say, I want to know how you're doing, I want to know how recovery's going, I want to understand more about your internal process with this whole dynamic. So where am I with the enablement piece? I honestly think that, you know, enabling an addict is basically saying, not enabling, but maybe not helpful, to say, you do what you're doing and I don't care. Just come to me healed, kind of thing.
The word enable is really catching me, because I don't see it as enabling, and I can hear people's stories of trying to help. Mm-hmm. And I can see a pathological view of that's enabling, which is bad. And really it's not, it's I'm trying to help my loved one. I'm trying to make sense of this crazy situation. I don't understand
our relationship
what's going on.
Together. I'm trying to keep our relationship together.
I'm trying to keep a relationship together. And so when actually I'm hearing this question from the mailbag, when I'm taking it as, how can I not impact my person's addictive behavior? Like if I'm choosing to not have sex with them because I don't feel comfortable to do so, am I interacting? Am I influencing their addiction? Am I accidentally making it worse, for example? Or let's go for the flip one. If I'm choosing to have a lot more sex because I'm trying to find a way to help my loved one, I feel like it's always back to the person trying to, betrayed partner usually, trying to make sense of it and trying to help the situation, which sometimes can backfire accidentally.
But even on those situations,
I'm not enable.
But even if the addict is triggered one way or the other, that's still their responsibility to use their recovery tools. So
1,000%.
If I'm, you know, emotionally triggered by something or, you know, sexually, whatever, it's my responsibility to take care of that in a healthy way, not go act out, right? Like that's not, so
yes,
it's not
did anything I say give
no
give
no no
impression otherwise?
No not at all.
I was like, oh my god, let
no,
me
no,
back
no.
up the bus.
Not at all. No, I just okay. I'm thinking, because that sometimes gets put on the partner, you know, if you only did X, Y, and Z, or you didn't do this, or you gave, like, then it's, and that becomes part of gaslighting and putting that on the partner and responsibility on the partner when it's not. It's the
right.
Sure, there's things that can help or harm, but that's not the partner's job to manage, right?
Right. That's part of that accountability and responsibility taking.
And there's a lot of nuance. I mean, you know, I'm very fond of telling people I work with, look, everybody's unique and nobody's unique, which means that there are some general patterns we see, but every person, every relationship, every addict, every partner is going to have their nuances. And so, you know, it's not like there's really an effective do these things and don't do those things and everything's going to be fine. I think if a partner is worried about, and I agree with you, Jeannie, I don't like the word enable. It feels very pathologizing. But if a partner is worried that what they're doing is in somehow facilitating the addict's addictive behaviors and creating more chaos in their life, the addict's life, and the people around them's life, I think it's a piece of, well, step back. Well, is this working? This is what I'm doing. This is why I'm doing it. I'm trying for the best. I'm not going to beat myself up for that, but is it actually working? And let's look at the reality of, is this getting me the result that I'm hoping it would create, or is it not? And if it's not, then maybe we need to acknowledge that and ask for help and guidance from other people and doing it differently.
The end. Great.
No, I actually have one more thing I want to say.
All right.
Okay.
Not the end. I was lying. I'm sorry.
I just, if this blows things up, we can totally take it out. That's totally fine. It can be the end. I still think though, so it's not enabling on any level. So I want to take that word out of it.
Yes.
But what I've experienced, what I've seen, and I'm just curious for you all, is for the betrayer, for the addict, until the pain of staying the same becomes greater than the pain of change, they don't move. So sometimes that means they finally get that the partner's serious about this. So they get the betrayal, they get the impact. You know, it means sometimes it's all the way to, I'm filing divorce for divorce if you aren't willing to do the work. So sometimes, and I don't know what to call that. So I'm not saying if you don't go to those lengths, that's not enabling. So I would never say that, of course, but I've just seen those situations where until the betrayer fully gets that this is really serious, sometimes if it's like comfortable enough, they don't make major shifts. So
isn't that human behavior though?
That discomfort sometimes comes from the partner, but sometimes the addict gets to that point on their own. And so I agree with you that until it's uncomfortable enough, the addict isn't going to change. But sometimes addicts walk in to my office saying, I'm miserable. This isn't working. I want to change. And sometimes
that's great, but that's rare for me, what I see.
I have about 25 to 35% of the guys that walk in my office that whether the partner has said you need to go do the work or not, they're walking, maybe it's even 50-50, that'll walk in, they're like, this isn't working for me, I want to be different, I don't know how to, I've been trying, I can't stop, I mean, addiction. But sometimes but that just still... because of the partner sort of putting boundaries in place or whatever they're doing, sometimes that comes internally from the addict and their own personal experience.
Whether it comes from locus of control or origin, rather, from betrayed partner into the relationship or from the addict, I think going back to the real truth, the biological truth of something Dan just said, which is until what I'm doing is uncomfortable enough, we humans tend to tolerate a lot. And so it has. And so, Dan, can you go back and say it again? Because you said it so beautifully. And I think it's a really human thing, and we're just applying it into these situations.
Yeah, most of us, and I know this is a quote, and I've heard it passed down, so I'm going to butcher it, but this is the idea is most of us don't change until the pain of staying the same is greater than the pain of change.
There it is. And again, I just want to emphasize the humanness of that.
Yeah.
No matter if the situation, the relationship, the addiction, the pain of staying the same is no longer an option.
And I would also add that some partners will try to motivate the addict to change. Mm-hmm. And I consistently don't find that behavior or words from that place works. When the partner is certain of where they stand, that is much more powerful than trying to think up what they can do or say to change the addict's behavior.
It's so hard. That's just so hard. I want to, you know, now we're going on down another street, but
hold on. Here's another
hold
question.
On. Let me do the so hard part, because you know, betrayed partners, they want healing. They want healing. They want healthy relationships. And of course they do. Everybody does. And so they're trying to think of, well, what could I do? What could we do? What could I ask him to do or her to do? Because they're seeking health and truth and connection. So I just want to acknowledge the heart of that, the pain of that. Okay, Tim, back to you.
Okay.
So, what was that look on your face, Tim?
Well, okay, here's where I'm going.
Uh-oh.
What Jeannie just said isn't exclusive to the partner. Mm-hmm. Addicts want love and acceptance and connection. Mm-hmm. Now, and when we talk clinically about sex addiction, we talk about it as an intimacy disorder. That's what addicts want at their core, but reaching out and being vulnerable with another person doesn't feel safe to them. And so they found these sexual behaviors to give them an artificial hit for that. So when we're talking about this, I want to be cautious that we don't just assume that it's only the partners who want that intimacy and that connection. Addicts want it too. Some of them actively want it with their partner. They just don't know how to go there because their pain and the trauma and all the stuff underneath driving it has been so ingrained, and they desperately want it to be different. They're having a hard time getting there, but it's not for a lack of desire for that connection, that intimacy, that love and acceptance.
So thank you for saying that, because that is not my what I wanted to say. I was just coming and off of what Wendy had talked about, which was specific to betrayed partners. And so yes, but it is there for both.
And we have
relationship partners.
And we have a betrayal, trauma, or a partner specific mailbag today. So here's the next question.
Oh, these are all betrayal partner focused?
Yeah, kinda.
All righty. Next one. All right.
And this fits in with all the stuff we've been talking about. What's the best role a partner can take towards the addicted spouse? How to hold boundaries while not being their therapist or their sponsor?
Oof. Good one.
Okay, what was the first question? Because I had a really fast response for that one.
What's the best role for a partner to take? Now, I'm going to say, that kind of asks, how do I do this perfectly? And it's not going to be the same answer for everyone, but what is an effective role for a partner to take? Let's change it there. What's an effective role for a partner to take? How can they be supportive of the addict, but not become their therapist and not become their sponsor?
Or cheerleader.
Which could be a choice, because it's not bad to be a cheerleader, but it's just not responsibility and obligation to be a cheerleader. I went back to, I think, how do I say this? First step for my recommendation, how can I be supportive of someone else, but not losing myself? So betrayed partner, really coming into awareness about what are my emotional needs, physical needs, sexual needs? What do I like? What do I value? What is the way I conceptualize this? And then through that sense of knowing self, and what would I like to choose to offer in support of my loved one who's trying to do this addiction treatment, or in support of this loved one who possibly betrayed me? But I would encourage betrayed partners to start with self, because then you can make more of an informed choice about what would I like to offer and gift or extend of myself. What do you guys think about that?
Well, I think this is a complicated question. So I really want anyone, but certainly a betrayed partner, to know when they're in trauma. So when I'm in the room with an addict or a partner, doesn't, you know, or both, when anybody is increasing their speech, so the speech is getting very fast, it's getting very high, they're repeating things a lot, that to me, that's a sign you're in trauma. So sometimes I will ask people to definitely do active listening. You know, what did you hear the other person say? Since this partner is saying, well, what can I do? I would say, first of all, if you want to be supportive, write out what you're going to say ahead of time. And it should be maybe 3 sentences.
Not compound sentences.
of support?
3 sentences, whatever you want to say. I would say whatever you want to say, about 3 sentences, so that you are being very cognizant about what you want to say, how you want to say it, and, you know, is this really, you know, what I'm trying to communicate, so that there's not repetition, the other person isn't getting flooded, the other person isn't saying things that they maybe don't want to say.
Are you talking about like difficult conversations or just regular old conversations, say 3 sentences at a time?
The very beginning, just try it.
Hmm.
Because I think that from discovery to disclosure and after disclosure, there's so many overwhelming feelings, so many overwhelming thoughts, that how can anybody trust themselves that what they're saying is truly on point and truly what they want to say? So what I find a lot is that partners will overdo it, and then the addict gets flooded or is very confused about what the partner is saying or not saying. So how do we simplify communication, hone it in? So that the partner also has a checkpoint for themselves.
What would you say, Tim, is something that a betrayed partner could do to help? Because, I mean, that's the question.
Getting is back. It help or role to take? Can you read it again?
The question was what role to take. And as I'm thinking about let's go backwards. I mean, when you think about a therapist, and I'm going to oversimplify here just for simplicity's sake, a therapist's role is to help people put pieces together so they can understand where something came from and how to change that behavior or how to change that dynamic. And a sponsor's role is to hold someone accountable and to guide them through the steps. And so as a partner, it's going to be ineffective if you're busy as the partner of an addict trying to help them understand their background and get them to change their behaviors. You're going to step into all kinds of things and you're going to get pushback from your partner who doesn't like you meddling and taking that kind of control. Also, it's not going to be helpful as a partner if you're stepping into you know, you need to be accountable and I'm going to be your sponsor and make sure that you're doing everything you need to do. And are you working your steps and are you living up to that? That's somebody else's job. As a partner, the role that you can take on actually is be the partner. If you're hurt and you're angry, be hurt and angry and express that and talk about it appropriately. If you're feeling hopeful, share that you're hopeful. You know, if you've got fear and concern, share that you have fear and concern and ask that the addict work with you around that. You know, but really the best role you can be in is as the partner. And I know that that's not easy, because when you're a partner and you've got that trauma and you're definitely trying to do safety seeking and protection and make sure that you're okay, that, you know, there's all kinds of things of, I desperately want to do this because I don't want to be hurt again. But the most effective role, if you're able to manage it, is be the partner and be honest about what your experience is as that partner. That's my take.
I agree. And I have a wrench. Okay. The wrench is, I don't disagree. And those roles being clearly defined and delineated sounds great, but we know some people don't seek therapy. Some people don't have a sponsor. They don't do this program, blah, blah, blah. The show's all that stuff. But the thing is, I've just seen partners are more aware of the train wreck coming than the addict is oftentimes. So they'll see the warning signs. They'll see the lead up. They'll see other things starting to slip. You know, it may not be the actual, the relapse isn't happening right now, but they're seeing all these other warning signs that the addict seems clueless about. So now what does that partner do? Because, okay, I don't want to be sponsor. I don't want to be therapist. And yet I see this train wreck and the addict is like, no, I'm fine. When we know they're probably not fine. So
there's a difference between steps and the therapist role, which is,
so there it is.
So what?
so let's understand the origins of this and what are you going to do and what's your plan? Right.
Into it and try and like get to that.
And a sponsor, you know, and a sponsor is going to be like, you know, you're missing this. This is what you need to do. You need to call me. You're not calling me. You need to step in. Come on. What are we doing? We're working the steps. If that's coming up as a partner, you know, go to the addict and say, hey, I've got some concerns. I'm seeing these red flags that are coming up for me and they're bringing a concern. And I am worried that you're heading down this pathway.
No, I'm fine. I'm fine.
So,
okay.
It would be meaningful for me if you would have this conversation with guys in program and just see if they see something going on as well. And then if you could come back and let me know what your thoughts are. Or if you're in therapy, go talk to your therapist about this. Maybe I am just in my own stuff and I'm hyper-reactive to something. But if you would please go explore that with other people and then come back to me, that'd be great. Now, if you're an addict and you're listening to this, the correct answer is not what Dan said. No, I'm fine. And when you go talk to people, the correct answer is not coming back and saying, I talked with them and I'm not seeing anything. I'm fine.
First there's another step. Actually talk to those people and don't give them the skewed, oh, my wife is kind of crazy and she thinks blah, blah, blah. And, you know, give, be real about it and take it
right
with seriousness. Right.
And if you find something, come back to your partner and say, here's what I realized, here's what's going on, and here's my plan. But if you talk to those people and you come up with nothing, the answer is, and I'm giving you the answer here, just say these words. The answer is, I talked with them and I'm not seeing something, but you might be picking up on something that's not on our radar. So I'm going to be extra careful with my program, extra careful with my boundaries, and I really appreciate you sharing your concerns with me.
Yeah. That's the right answer.
And I also just want to validate, you know, that betrayed partners, you know, when because a lot of betrayed partners, right, read all the information, listen, you know, okay, you know, there's this intensive you can do this, you can do that. They really want the addict to stop their behavior and to figure out, you know, what caused the behavior and to put in place things so that the behavior doesn't happen again. You know, so I sometimes find that the partners, you know, really watching and waiting, is this going to change? And so I just want to validate how frustrating it can be for a partner, you know, when the addict says, yeah, well, you know, we had a family dinner tonight, so I missed my meeting. I thought the family dinner was more important. And the partner's like, are you kidding me? Like, you know, no, your recovery, like the partner knows, I think, that the recovery is most important. Although I have had situations where they say, hey, aren't you going to be at the kid's birthday party? Sure. And then the addict says, wow, my recovery, what's most important?
But then that's a family stuff, discussion.
Right? Family stuff or recovery stuff. And as Jeannie said, you know, it has to be part of the discussion. But I find what happens a lot is that the addicts are not communicating. Well, it's an intimacy disorder. So this is a new skill. If I'm going to a meeting, I have to learn how to communicate and what I'm going to communicate to my partner when I get back home. And to start that higher level of connection and information sharing.
And Tim, I like Tim's answer. That is the answer. I've heard too many people use some version of, well, just remember this is progress, not perfection. You know, you can't expect me to be perfect. And that's like the end of the story or something. That's not the right answer. So rewind what Tim just said and use that.
I agree.
So to repeat, it's, I may not be seeing it. I'll go check with my people. I know that you see things before I do. I'll keep this in mind. I know I'll make an extra phone call. Thanks for bringing it to my attention.
And then do it.
Do it. Thank you all for the mailbag questions. Keep them coming. I know we've got more, but I also know we're running out of time today.
That's it for today. And if you're, well, whatever platform you're listening to us on, please like us and rate us. It actually makes a significant difference in people being able to find us out there. And we are so passionate about bringing the message and the fun to all the people out there. And also, if you have questions for us that you would like to have us address in a future mailbag, send those to us at conversations.sar@gmail.com. Thanks for joining us in this conversation.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks.